This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio here on NPR One. I'm Greta Mart.
Morro Bay resident Chris Christensen will be in Nashville, the Ryman Auditorium to be exact, on August 22nd to receive the Academy of Country Music Founders Award. Christensen's mother and father started the Country Music Awards back in 1964 at the family-owned Red Barrel Nightclub in the Los Angeles community of Hawaiian Gardens. The Red Barrel was a magnet for trend-setting California-based country performers like Merle Haggard, Buck and Bonnie Owens, George Jones, and Eddie Miller. It wasn't long before the Christensen's annual Country and Western Music Academy Award performances at the Red Barrel caught the eye of Dick Clark Productions. The venue was switched to the Hollywood Palladium in 1966. Western was dropped from the new name, Academy of Country Music Awards, fondly dubbed the ACMs, that's now held annually at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. 54 years later, Mickey and Chris Christensen are posthumously being honored as the Academy's founders with the prestigious ACM Honors, Maybora and Axton Service Award. Come along and join Chris Christensen Jr. as he recounts tales of growing up immersed in his family's world of country music, his younger years centered around partying, adventuring, surfing, and an interlude as a drug smuggler, before his eventual rebirth as a talent agent. 74-year-old Christensen is still at it today, working with Ken McMean's Productions, representing musicians from Nashville to Texas and across the West. Let's start with here and now, with the month of August 2018. A really touching month for you, isn't it?
Actually, the culmination, Tom, of 54 years of history that myself and my sister and I lobbied for at least 30 of those years. After my father passed away, we realized that they never really got a lot of recognition from the ACM.
And ACM is?
The Academy of Country Music. Mom and Dad, two of the four founders of the Academy of Country Music Awards show, actually it was originally called the Academy of Country Western Music. Mm-hmm. When Dick Clark Productions took over the television production of the show, they decided the Academy of Country Western Music was a little too long, and so they shortened it to the Academy of Country Music.
You're off in a few days to Nashville, Tennessee, and you're going to receive an award in absentia for your mom and dad.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, I'll get two awards because they were two individuals of the four. They're also going to present that evening to Eddie Miller, who was also one of the other founders, along with Tommy Wiggins. Tommy Wiggins was recognized 2 years ago. He was the last of the four founders that was alive. And so they gave Tommy the Founders Award, the May Boren Axton Award for founding the Academy. And it took them a couple years to get it together to where they could actually recognize both Mom and Dad and Eddie Miller. Eddie Miller was actually a very well-known country western writer. He wrote Release Me, a number of other historic country songs. Academy of Country Music recognized him long before he was actually known as one of the founders. He was better known for a music writer, country music writer. I think it must have been, well, it was about 8 years ago now, so yeah, right around 2000, I guess. I had decided, Mom was getting up there in age, and she was still living here with us. And so I hadn't talked to anybody with the Academy for quite a while. But I called up the Academy, asked to talk to Bob Romeo, who was the CEO at the time, because I keep getting these from Mom's. She was always an honorary member of the Academy. Mm-hmm. And they have a quarterly production called The Tempo, which is
a magazine.
A magazine, all the latest news on what the Academy of Country Music Awards show is doing, and their last show, and pictures and stuff like that from the last show.
And they do the awards in the Ryman Auditorium?
They have two awards. The actual one that's televised every year is done out of the MGM Grand in Las Vegas.
Okay.
It's kind of progressed. It started at the Palladium, then it went to the Beverly Hilton for a few years, and then they moved to Universal Studios for quite a few years. And then from there, they moved to Las Vegas. And they've been in Las Vegas at the MGM Grand now for quite a few years.
Okay, well, why do I keep thinking of the Ryman?
Because my dad's penchant for the musicians and the writers and the producers and the agents and the radio stations, They started a separate award show at a different time of the year every year called the Honors, ACM Honors
okay.
Award. At that show, honor all of the background people. Like I said, writers, promoters, radio stations. And they decided to hold that show in Nashville at the Ryman Auditorium.
Okay.
And so that's what they've been doing for the last few years.
Okay, and that's why they're kidnapping you and
that's
taking you there.
That's why they invited me to go to the Ryman, because they've been doing it there, and that's where they want to honor Mom and Dad with that last one.
That's August 22nd?
Yeah, this August 22nd. Yeah. And it's, like I said, it's a culmination of 54 years. But what I was getting to is I'd kind of let it all slide for a lot of years, but a few years ago, like I said, I caught a hold of the Academy. And I called and asked for Bob Romeo, and they said, you know, what would you like to talk to Bob about? He's the CEO of the company. You know, they didn't know me. I said, well, I just wanted to talk to him a little bit about getting tickets for the show for my mom. And she goes, oh, well, we have people that handle the tickets. What was your name? I said, well, it's Chris Christensen. And she goes, Chris Christensen? And she recognized that name. She said, can you hold on a moment? Because she was going to shuffle me on to the ticket guy that sells the ticket. But she ran and she got a hold of Bob, and she told Bob, she said, there's a Chris Christensen on the phone. Well, I had never met Bob, and Bob had never met my mom or my dad, because he became CEO after Dad passed away, and Mom hadn't been involved for a lot of years. So all of a sudden, Bob Romeo's on the phone, and he goes, this is Bob. What was your name? I said, it's Chris Christensen. He goes, are you related to... Chris and Mickey that were the founders? I went, yeah, I'm their son. He says, well, what can I do for you? And I said, well, my mom is getting up in age. And he goes, wait, your mom is still alive? I said, yeah, she's 92 years old, but I have been dying to take her to another show before she can't go. She's in a wheelchair and her hearing's getting real bad, but I know she would enjoy it, at least one more show. He goes, OMG. He said, we thought Mickey had passed away several years ago. We knew your dad did, but absolutely. He said, just let me know how many of you are coming, when you want to get there. I will have a hotel room for you. I'll have a limo waiting to pick you up at the airport. It was red carpet treatment, and Bob Romeo lived up to his word. We had front row seating.
And your mom was big smile.
Oh, my gosh. And one of my mom's favorite artists by that time was George Strait. Mm-hmm. And he had a song, something about waltzing across Texas or something like that. That was a big hit a few years before. And it so happened the year that we had gotten a hold of Bob and we're going to go, they were recognizing George as the artist of the decade. So we made all these arrangements to go and show up. And about 2 weeks before the show, Bob called up and he said, Chris, he said, I want to introduce your mom and I want to give her some recognition. I went, oh my gosh, that is so just exactly what I always wanted. Our family's never been able to seal their legacy, so to speak, other than there is if you look on their webpage, it says founders Chris and Mickey Christensen. And he says, no. But he said, what I want to do is I want George Strait to present a little award to your mom.
How cool.
You think she'd be okay with it? I said, well, she might freak out and scream or something, but I know she'd be okay with it. So he goes, oh, great. He says, so he set it all up. I told Mom, unfortunately, I told her that was going to happen. But we got over there in Vegas, and we were actually sitting in the auditorium watching Tim McGraw rehearse and Martina McBride. And Bob was back with CBS does the production, and they're in the sound booth there, not too far from where we were sitting, like 14,000-seat auditorium, but there's only about 10 or 20 of us in there. And all of a sudden, I hear the yelling and screaming going on. I went, ooh, what's going on over there, you know? And then I turn around, and Bob just, like, storms away from the sound booth. And he goes around the back door, and he comes back over, and he goes, Chris, you got a minute? And he catches my attention off the side. I said, yeah, what's up? And he goes, I am so mad. He said, but they will not let me give your mom the award because they said 30 seconds is worth too much money.
Wow.
30 seconds is worth $300,000 or something like that.
Wow.
And they won't let me do it. He said, I get to open the show up before we go live on television. And I'll introduce Jim Parr. He's always the MC for the show. So they turn the lights on and turn the music down, and Bob walks out on the stage, and they introduce him over the loudspeaker, CEO, da-da-da-da. And Bob said, welcome, whatever it was, the 48th annual, yada, yada, yada. He said, but before we start the show, I would like to introduce a special guest or something like that. Tonight, one of the founders is here. And so he said, Mickey Christensen, and she's right down over here in the front row. And, of course, the spotlight comes over there. And I didn't tell her that she wasn't going to be able to get the award from George, excuse me. And she says, what's happening? What's happening? And the spotlight's on her. And I'm like, Mom, you need to stand up. And she's like in a wheelchair. But so I had to grab her butt and kind of push her up. And then she realized she's in a spotlight, and everybody, you know, 14,000 people are applauding and whatever. And now all of a sudden she's a star. And she's waving to everybody.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And then, of course, the spotlight goes on. And then Bob's like, okay, Mom, you can sit down now. She's still waving to everybody. But it was so cool that she finally got that recognition, you know. But that was all she got. Unfortunately, they never got to give her an award or anything like that. And
but you're doing it now.
Bob apologized later that night. They had a big after-party show for George. We were up at that party. Bob came over and he said, I am so sorry that I couldn't do what I wanted to do and get you. And he said, but I am going to do my best to get the board to recognize your mom and your dad and give them an award for being founders. He said, I just want you to know that I'll do everything I can to make that happen.
And it's happening.
Yeah. Bob and actually his executive secretary, Lisa Lee, bless her heart, she actually came up here from L.A. with a film crew and filmed an interview with Mom. And when she did that, she just fell in love with my mom. She says, your mom is so cute and so adorable, and she has so much history. I just love her to death, and Bob and I are going to make sure that they get recognized somehow. That was like 6, 7 years ago now, and I had kind of almost forgotten about it, you know.
So all of a sudden, out of the blue, you got
contacted? Oh, yeah, about 4 months ago, early in the morning, like 8 o'clock or something like that, my phone rings, and she goes, Chris, this is Lisa Lee. I went, Lisa Lee, how the hell are you? What's going on? You know, it was a total shock. I had decided, you know, it cost like $3,000-$4,000 for us to go to the show every year. But Lisa said, well, I just wanted you to know that we have finally gotten the board to agree to honor your mom and dad, and we're going to give them the May Born Ashton Founders Award at the Ryman, at the Honors Awards in August, and we would like you to come and receive the awards for your mom and dad.
Wow. Meant to be.
Yeah. They say sometimes, I posted not too long ago when they actually made the announcement and made it public. They sent me a press release, and I just reproduced it on my Facebook page. And I started off by saying, never say never, which was something my dad used to always say. So, you know, they were farmers from Iowa, the cornfields of Iowa, and they came to California in pursuit of the American dream, and they achieved it, you know, and they went way beyond even their own expectations. And my brother and my sister, by that time, had passed away from cancer. My dad had passed away from cancer, and Mom was the only surviving relative that I had. And then, a couple of years ago, she got pancreatitis at 96, and she passed away. And so it was like that. It became obvious that they were never going to get to see that recognition themselves. But my sister and I, she was always my best friend, but her and I always said that someday, somehow, we're going to find a way to convince the board to recognize them and get that award that would kind of seal their legacy, not just a little article in a magazine, you know, or on their webpage. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, my brother, my sister, and my dad, my mom never got to see that. I'm sure they're looking down, and they're pretty pleased.
That's so cool. Your family history is really, in a lot of respects, under the radar. A lot of people don't know.
Yeah, it really
There's
really
a
is.
Morro Bay connection.
Yeah, well, nobody would know it up here hardly at all. One of the best memories I think I'll ever have in my life, and just as a summary for you, is during that George Strait Awards and the after party, I was up at the bar And like I said, Mom always idolized George Strait, but he was up in front of the whole 300 or 400 people there for this private party. And of course, there was a big long line of people that wanted his autograph and everything. And him and his wife were up in the front. But I was standing at the bar, and Montgomery Gentry, they were standing up at the bar alongside of me. And he's a big old guy, you know, and I got this wild hair. I said, "Hey, man, what's going on?" You know, we're just chit-chatting. He goes, "Hey, you want? What do you want? What are you drinking, man? Let me buy you a drink." And I said, "Oh, I'll take a shot of Patron tequila on the rocks." He goes, "Hey, my man," you know, a little bump. So then I looked at him. I said, "Hey, would you do me a favor?" He said, "If I can, what you need? What you need?" And I said, "Well, you know, Mickey Christensen was one of the founders of the." He says, "I know who Mickey is, man. I've been around here long enough to know who she is. Is she here?" I go, "Yeah, that's my mom." He goes, you know, I said, "Yeah, she's right back there in a wheelchair, but it would be so cool if I could get her from there through all this crowd of people up to say hi and meet George Strait." He goes, "Come with me."
Oh, how cool.
So, you know, he's a big guy. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, he just opened the big old line wide open straight to Mom's wheelchair, and he walked back there with his big old hat, you know, and he says, "Hey, Mickey, how y'all doing?" And she goes, "Hi." And she didn't recognize him at all. I, "Mom, Montgomery Gentry, you know those guys?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah, how are you?" You know, he goes, "Well, I heard you'd like to meet George Strait." And she goes, "Oh, sure, hell, why not?" You know, and she's like, "So, no big deal." And he says, "Well, come with me, follow me." So, again, from Mom's wheelchair straight to George up on the stage where there's all these people standing in line, all of a sudden there's a clean, clear shot for her in a wheelchair because he's just going through there going, "Out of the way, out of the way, out of the way. Mickey Christensen's on her way down here. Get out, get back out of the way." He's just pushing people out of the way. I pushed her wheelchair right up there, and we got up right next to George, and his wife looks at me, and she goes, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Well, Mickey here is one of the founders, and she would just like to meet your husband." She goes, "Hang on a second." So she whispers in George's ear while he's signing autographs. She tells him, "Hey, Mickey's one of the founders right here in the wheelchair. She just wanted to meet you." And he said, "Sorry, folks, but I'm going to have to stop signing autographs for a minute or two. I'm going to meet Mickey here, one of the founders of this here academy. And so give me a few minutes if you wouldn't." And so he walks away from that, walks over and kneels down. And Mom is like a kid in a candy store. And she goes, "Oh, my God, thank you." She said, "You know, I would waltz across Texas to meet you." And I went, "Oh, God, well, that's so corny." And he just laughed, you know. And he looks down at her and gets down on one knee. And he goes, "Mickey, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you."
Very cool, yeah.
At that point, Tom, I don't even think I cared whether she ever got an award.
That was her award.
That was. Her idol. One of the biggest country western stars to ever hit the stage said something like that to Mom, and he meant it, you know. Mm-hmm. And he recognized his fame and his fortune and his success was all because of the level of recognition and notoriety that country music got over the last 50 years. It went from shit-kicking music to one of the highest paid genres in the music industry, which is one of the reasons, like, they were doing a lot of crossover music. Rock and roll musicians all of a sudden wanted to be country musicians because they could make more money in the country charts.
That's still happening.
Yeah, that still is. They are still doing that. So, and music has evolved. You know, a lot of people... I loved what Toby Keith said not too long ago in a special he did with Dean Dillon. But he said, "You know, I don't care whether I am famous anymore or not." He said, I had my gig. And he said, "I don't care where country music goes. Some people call it bro music now." He said, "But you know what? We did our thing, and we were successful at it. Let these young guys do their thing. And if they're successful at it, more power to them. I don't care what you call it or what you think of it. If they call it country and country music fans are buying it, more power to them."
So let's go back in time, what, 6 decades, and your mom and dad are young and going for it, and they had a bar. And that's really where that whole music scene started.
Yeah, they did. Dad was owner of a jukebox company called Melody Music back in the 50s. And they had jukeboxes in nightclubs and bars all over California, mostly around the Southern California area. But some of them were up in the Bakersfield area. But one of the things with jukeboxes is they had to continually put new 45s on the jukeboxes in order to keep up with what was being played on the radios and that nature. And actually, when I was about 14 years old, because I did nothing but listen to the radio all day long, my dad would take me up to Capitol Records in Hollywood. He'd turn me loose in their record department down in the basement, be thousands and thousands of 45s, and he'd say, okay, pick me out 200 45s of different types of music so that we can keep them on the jukebox. And we'd take them home, and my mom and sister would type up the little labels and slide them into the jukeboxes and the little counter...
Restaurants and cafes, the little countertop ones?
Yeah, they're right. And then
punch the numbers and the alphabet.
Yeah, exactly. G4, yeah. B7, you know, they've written some great songs about stuff like that. Yeah. But and then as a side note, my dad would also have to install sometimes a lot of the sound system. And so a lot of times he had to crawl up in the attic and run the wires from the jukebox over to the speakers throughout the restaurant or the bar. Because the attics were usually pretty small, I was like the little rabbit. He would send me
you up there.
Yeah, he'd send me up there, and I'd pull the wires through and pull them down through the holes. And it was a lot of fun, and I got a lot of exposure to music myself. But over the years, you know, I realized that my dad had a real penchant for and love for country music. And although he had to put all kinds of music on the jukeboxes, his favorite was always country music. And so I was always given the instructions to get the majority of good country music. And, you know, those would be guys like George Jones and Buck Owens and the Buckaroos and Merle Haggard and some of those guys. One of my favorite stories back in the day was one day I was picking out records, and my dad was with one of the buyers there at Capitol, and he was told that there was one of my dad's favorite artists, Dean Martin, was recording downstairs somewhere. So Dad went down there and was listening to Dean Martin recording a cut on an album. And he came up and he said, man, I just heard the greatest guitar player I have ever heard in my life. He's just a backup musician, but this guy is so talented. It's unbelievable. I said, well, what's his name, you know? He said, yeah, his name's Glenn Campbell. Nobody knows him. He's just a studio musician. And it was rather ironic because I think it was 2, maybe 3 years later, after they founded the Academy of Country Music, Glenn actually got New Artist of the Year. From the Academy. They recognized him and his talent, and wasn't sure too long after that he wrote a lot of his iconic hits, you know, Rhinestone Cowboy and on and on and on. And he became a good friend of my mom.
Let's get back to the birth of the Academy.
Well, they owned several nightclubs, the C&M Corral, Hunter's Inn, all over Southern California. They started buying bars after the music business, and they were doing real well with that. And then they met a gentleman that had a big nightclub, and he wanted to get out of it. And we found out later why he wanted to get out of it. He owed IRS a lot of money, but we didn't know about. So he turned the club over to Mom and Dad. It was called the Red Barrel Nightclub, and it was down in Southern California, a little unknown town pretty much, known as Hawaiian Gardens, just outside of Los Alamitos in Seal Beach, California. But it was a big club. It could hold 300-400 people. It had a huge dance floor and a big stage. And George Underwood, the gentleman that used to own it, was willing to turn it over to Mom and Dad if they wanted to take it over. And they thought, wow, this is kind of a gold mine, because they had a lot of connections by then, knew a lot of people, and they thought they could make it work with live music. And George just wasn't promoting it well, which is why he was losing money on it. So they took it over. Of course, they found out a year later that they owed IRS $125,000, showed up one day with the padlocks on the door, and they had to make a deal with IRS to let them work off the bill, which they eventually did, and they opened it back up, and they started booking big-name acts like George Jones and Buck Owens and Merle Haggard and those guys that were pretty well-known. And
Buck Owens and Merle, they were based in Bakersfield, weren't
they? Yeah, that was when they started. There was this, you know, little chatter going around Southern California that there was this thing called the Bakersfield Sound. And they had known of it and about it up there because, like I said, Dad had some jukeboxes up in that area. And so he knew there was a lot of country music up there. And Buck Owens was kind of like iconic, and Merle Haggard. They were just good old boys singing, as they used to call it, shit-kicking music, you know. And I think that in itself was one of the motivating factors. Then when he became friends with this Eddie Miller, he used to love coming down to the club. He didn't live far from there. And him and Dad would hang out. And like my mom said, she sells it, my dad drinks it. You know, the Dad and Eddie Miller would sit around and get pretty good buzz going and start talking about country music and whatever. And they thought that the country music really deserved a lot more recognition than it was getting. It certainly wasn't just shit-kicking music. There was a lot of fights and things that went in on bars, you know. But they just thought that the musicians were a lot better than they were getting recognized for. And so...
In what period of time was this? What year?
This was probably 1961, 62, right about in there. I was just graduating high school. I wasn't a real big fan of country music, but, you know, mom and dad, and they had this club, and I'd go down there and hang out and meet all kinds of girls that were coming in and out of the bar, and they were all good-looking. They were older than me, you know, but that was kind of fun, you know. Eventually, I got to understand what my dad really loved about me, especially when I saw these musicians playing live, you know, and I started listening to the lyrics. And then I started watching everybody dance into all that, you know, doing the two-step. My dad was a great dancer, and all the women were always wanting to dance with him. And I thought, well, that's kind of cool, you know. I got kind of jealous. And so I learned how to do the two-step eventually. And pretty soon I was out there dancing, you know, and had a really good time for those few years down there. Dad and Eddie and this Tommy Wiggins, who was a local disc jockey and a singer himself and songwriter, they got together and they said, well, you know, we should recognize some of these musicians that don't get any recognition at all, and let's just have a little award show for them here at the bar, at the club. So they talked it over, and they decided in 1964, I think, to have an award show there at the Red Barrel Nightclub. So they put plywood over the top of the pool tables and moved all the chairs back and had a little MC and some good live music. We had a house band at the time. I think it was Jerry Inman and the Roadmen. So they put together this little award show, and all the local women brought food. You know, it was like a potluck thing, you know. So it was just a real good time, and they talked it over, like who they thought was up and coming and who was good musician and who was playing backup and who was writing and so on and so forth. And they really wanted to recognize as much as anything the musicians and the writers and the people in the industry that never got any mention at all, except for the big headliners. So that's kind of where it got started in my mind and my recognition of it all. That first year was really a lot of fun, and they decided it was so much fun, and they started getting people calling, well, you know, we want to be a part of it, you know, and have you thought of this guy? Have you heard about this guy, you know? And so they started getting all kinds of referrals and references for different musicians, and they would come into the club and kind of audition and play some of their music, and of course they'd have to give them a resume or what have you done, you know, where have you played, do you have a good following or whatever. They used all that kind of as a criteria to give them nomination, and then they'd get the musicians that they knew in the area and all the local bands, house bands especially, have them vote on all these different musicians. They held the second award show there. And
called what at that time again?
It was called the Academy of Country Western Music. The second year they realized they really needed to form a board to have some uniformity to it all, and they needed a secretary. Well, my mom was so busy running the bar, and she was really the business person. My mom was one of the very first women in the state of California to have a liquor license in her name. It was unheard of for women to have a liquor license in their name. But she was always kind of a pioneer of sorts. And she decided that she couldn't do both. So she hired a woman by the name of Fran Boyd, asked Fran if she would be the secretary for the board, and Fran agreed to it. And it turned out, as it was, that Fran Boyd's husband was Bill Boyd, who happened to be the production and producer for Dick Clark Productions. And he let Dick Clark know about this award show that his wife was getting involved in. It sounded kind of exciting. One thing led to another. Next thing you know, Dick Clark Productions got involved and made him an offer and wanted to take it and televise it nationally. And so when they did, they moved it to the Hollywood Palladium in Hollywood. And the third show was there at the Palladium.
Your mom and dad were still involved.
Yeah, they were still involved at that time. And, of course, we always got, you know, tables up front, and that was always fun. And of course, when it got televised, then all of a sudden everybody wanted to be a presenter or be involved somehow because their managers knew it was good PR. To get on television and to get exposure, even if it was just as a presenter, was a real feather in their cap. And so before I knew it, you know, guys like Dean Martin and Roy Clark and all kinds of different TV personalities were starting to come to the shows and being presenters. And so I got to meet a lot of really cool people. And I got to know Glenn Campbell pretty well. I remember when he started dating Tanya Tucker. She was like know, 16 or 17 years old. But she was the cutest little thing and spunky. We would run into Tanya and Glenn at Farmer's Market there in Hollywood every once in a while. And then it became pretty well known that they were kind of an item, but they were just so cute and fun. They had so much fun together, and they wrote some great music together, too. Those were just the early days, and I got to really meet a lot of different people, and I got kind of caught up in the Hollywood scene myself because now I'm like 18 years old, you know, and I think I'm pretty hot stuff, you know.
So what were you doing to survive?
Well, it was kind of crazy, but my buddies and I found out that if girls in Hollywood found out or thought there was some kind of a producer or somebody that was putting on a party that they might get discovered, they would come by the hundreds. So we started renting houses in Hollywood and just putting out the word that there's this producer, me, that was coming into town to interview for a film that I was working on, and we would stack the deck and have all these girls come into the parties. We just had a lot of fun, you know. Not something I want to be very proud of today, but, you know, 18 years old back in the 60s, you know, it was like, whatever. But after a while, that got old, and I really got tired of the whole scene. And I was also involved with surfing quite a bit myself at the time. And so I think in 1968, I'd gotten married by then. That wasn't going so well, and so I kind of decided to split Southern California. I left my wife, and I moved to Hawaii for a couple of years over in Lahaina town, Maui. Got into the surfing scene over there, and unfortunately I got into a lot of LSD and drugs and sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know. How I survived and lived through all that, I'm not really sure, but the grace of God. But after a few years of that nonsense, I got wise and got out of there and came back to California and decided it was time to kind of get serious about life. And I'd had a degree in mechanical engineering, and so I decided to follow that up and get serious about things. And I went to work for Douglas Aircraft, working Douglas Aircraft for a while. I did find out pretty soon, though, that I didn't like being in an office. I was so much of an outdoors type person that I asked to be transferred, actually, out of the engineering department out into the warehouse chasing parts down. So they gave me a golf cart and I'd run all over the plant looking for stuff that was lost all over the place. And I did that for a couple of years, and then I got tired of that. And I just started surfing during the summer and then snow skiing during the winters and kind of just chasing, you know, the fun life and having a good time.
But at some point, you went back in the music scene.
Yeah, I like I said, I did all that, and I chased around women and whatever. Been married 7 times.
Wow.
I'm on lucky 7 finally. I found a good woman and lucky that I found her. And she'd been just the right ingredient to teach me to...
Tame you a little
important.
Bit.
Important. She tamed me a whole lot, you know. And unfortunately, back in 96, my son at that time was 30 years old, and he passed away. Mm-hmm. That kind of rocked my boat, and it was at that time that I took a real serious look at life and started really reevaluating what my passions really were. And music kept coming up. You know, I knew music. I knew what was good and what wasn't good. I kind of learned all that ear from my dad. So I started looking around and see what I could do to get involved in music, and I just realized that I had a penchant for recognizing talent.
You probably inherited from your dad, huh?
Yeah, it really was. And not something I even knew that I had, except that it just was natural for me. And I'd be out at a club or I'd be wherever and hear somebody playing live music, and I'd go, wow, they're really good, you know, or they really stink. And so, as it were, you know, because of my exposure and the people that Mom and Dad knew in the industry, I was able to help a few musicians understand some of the hurdles and the path that it took to get recognized by record labels. In those days, they actually had records. Mm-hmm. Then cassettes came along, and then CDs came along. But still, the big labels like Sony, Warner, and Capitol Records, they had people that looked for talent. They would always give you an ear, especially if you knew somebody, and I did have some of those contacts. So if I saw somebody or heard somebody that I thought really had a lot of potential, you know, I could make a phone call and ask them to give them a listen. And so did that for a few years, and then got a little sidetracked again, moved to Florida for a while. And the easy money of drug smuggling kind of crept into my life, you know, it's still part of me, and was doing cocaine and smoking pot and all that stuff, but there was a real opportunity in Southern California. If you had the guts to smuggle stuff in, you can make some real money. And so I kind of got way in over my head down there doing that and found myself looking over my shoulder a whole lot.
I was going to say, you're lucky you're still alive.
Yeah, oh man, have no idea. I'll never forget one day I was sitting in a hotel room and I looked at the walls and it looked like blood was splattered on the walls. I went, what in the hell am I doing here? And I made this big deal and I had a suitcase full of pounds of cocaine. I got in my brand new little Jeep Cherokee and I'm headed back up from Lauderdale to West Palm Beach where I lived. And every time I looked in the rearview mirror, I was sure somebody was following me. I looked over my shoulder for a month or two until I got rid of that whole stash. And at that point, I realized that I really was not cut out for that kind of a world. The paranoia was not me. The easy money was not so easy. And something in the back of my mind, my mom had always taught me a little bit about right and wrong. And so I just cold turkey, quit it all, moved back to Arizona where my parents were living at the time. Started building houses with my dad.
Wow.
So I did that for several years back in Arizona and until dad passed away back in, I think, 82. And then I carried on doing the small remodels and stuff like that. I eventually started a landscape business and did all that for a couple more years in Arizona. And then the heat just got to me in Arizona. And I said, you know, I want to move back to Southern California. So I did. And when I came back to California, that's when I kind of picked up the music thing again.
How did that happen? Accidental almost?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, just bouncing around one job type into another and looking for things to do. And I met a guy after I left Southern California and moved up here by the name of Ken McMeans.
I know Ken. Yeah.
And I was talking in a local wine bar one day with a guy that's
was this
a writer.
When Ken was still in Hollywood?
No. Ken had left Hollywood and had moved up here.
To Morro Bay.
Yeah, to Morro Bay, of all places.
Well, that always cracks me up. I met him as a Nashville agent.
Yeah.
And he says, well, I live in Morro Bay. And I go, how can you do that?
Well, a lot of people ask that. You know, it wasn't easy.
He says, but you can live anywhere.
Well, that's true. As an if you're a Ken McMeans, Ken is he's the ultimate hustler, though. He just astounds me. But anyhow, I was sitting in this wine bar talking to this guy who had found out about my parents' association with the Academy of Country Music. He wanted to know more about it. He said he was interested in writing a story about it. So we're talking in this bar, and it so happens that Ken and his wife were in there having a glass of wine, and he overheard us talking, and he hollered over. He says, hey, man, you guys into country music? And I went, yeah, well, we have been over in the past. You know, he goes, he came over and introduced him. That's Ken, you know. He's a hugger, too. He comes over and gives me a big hug. He said, my name's Ken McMean, man. He said, I'm a booking agent. He said, what do you do? You know, what's your association? And we started talking about all that. Well, we just struck up a real good. And we're best friends to this day. And so Ken was telling me what he was doing. I went, damn, you know, that's kind of what I want to get back into. And he said, well, why don't you give me a hand, you know. And I've got this artist. He had some pretty good headliners from Nashville that he was booking around the area. He said, I always need help setting things up. And I knew a little bit about sound and PR work. And so we just kind of been working back and forth for, the last 6-7 years, you know.
So you're still an agent.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I discovered a great local artist that I thought had a tremendous amount of talent, but she had just moved up here from L.A. with her husband and didn't know anybody. And
you're going to tell us her name?
Yeah, her name is Cynthia Ford. A good friend of mine in Buffalo, Benford's, he is actually working on a documentary with Merle Haggard called The Jimmy Rogers Saga. And we ran into Buffalo somewhere, a local bar up in Paso, I think, and started talking country music and whatever. And he knew Cynthia from L.A. because she had her own band down there. And so we decided to do a tribute to Merle Haggard up at the Pine Street Saloon in Paso. And he invited this Cynthia to come up there, and she came up, and I went up there.
This
you
was
know.
After Merle passed away, right?
Yeah, no. Merle was actually still alive.
Oh, okay.
He was still alive at the time. Anyhow, Cynthia came up there, and she played a couple of songs. I went, damn, that girl has got a terrific voice. And so I talked to her afterward and told her I was really in awe of her voice. She goes, thank you. You know, I feel like I've been meant to sing my whole life, but I moved up here and I don't know what I'm going to do to try to, you know, get back into music. I said, well, Ken and I do a lot of local gigs and stuff. You know, would you be interested in doing some stuff with them? And one thing led to another, and we had her, I had started doing an open mic thing down at the wine cellar here locally and had her sing there a few times. And Ken had started a new group called Stereo Chickens.
Oh, so she's in Stereo Chickens.
Well,
yeah.
Ken had started it with his wife, and not very popular with Elizabeth, but I told Ken I didn't think Elizabeth was the right match for his voice. Mm-hmm. Said, if you ever change that, let me know, because I got a gal I think that might really work with you. And one thing led to another. Him and Cynthia are now the Stereo Chickens, and just the two of them, and they are doing good. In fact, we just had this release party in Nashville.
I was going to say, he was just down there, right?
Yeah, we just got back this week. We did a great release party in B.B. King's Blues Club, pretty successfully. One of big, well-known recording studios out of L.A., Gary Lux, he does a lot of the sound stuff for, like, the SAG Awards, big TV shows down there. Really cool guy. And he knew Ken when Ken was writing songs and recording in Hollywood. And when he told Ken that he was interested in what he was doing with the Stereo Chickens, Ken went down there and he took Cynthia, and Gary totally agreed with me. He called me like a week later. He said, you are spot on. This gal has got some potential. We need to get a recording of these guys. So he put together an album for them. He's helping promote them down there, and it's been pretty fun to watch all
that. And that's right now in real time. That's today, yeah.
Yeah, that's like all fast forward.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody wanted to follow you on Facebook or your website, how would they do that?
My website is CCAD Music. And entertainment, you know, it's got some of my history on there, but I don't update it much at all anymore. I'm getting old and cranky. And
all right. Well, Chris Christensen, thank you so much for sharing. This is fun, and it's an honor to call you a friend.
Well, the same here, Tom. I love what you do, and I really love the fact that you're interested in putting this out there and letting the public know some of the history of country music. And
thanks again, Chris.
My pleasure, Tom, and thank you for what you do for music, too.
My pleasure. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Morro Bay, California, where we've been visiting with the legend Chris Christensen.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Once again, svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others.